Good afternoon. So today my plan is to do exam review. The way that works is I'm going to take things you want me to talk about, which can be as specific or not specific as you like. I'm going to take a bunch of them and try to put them so related topics we discuss together. And then I'm going to go through those, and I'll ask for a second round. If we run out of things to talk about before the time is up, then we'll just end early. So what would people like me to talk about? Yes?
Can you go over the question on one of the quizzes about the scheduling, how you, I think it was the round robin scheduling?
Can we be more specific?
Yeah, I don't know if you have the quizzes up. I guess it's basically how overlapping in lottery scheduling works.
Over?
I'll pull the quiz and I'll ask you. Come back to me.
Okay.
Can you go with number four on the spring 2019
measure? Which is about?
The POSIX pipes.
Pipes, okay.
Redirecting files descriptors and
redirecting. Okay. Yeah.
Can you talk about context switches, the process, what happens?
Context switches, like where data is stored?
Yeah, sure.
Switching for, okay. Yeah. Okay, new text implementation or usage? Okay. What? Okay. Any what like implementation, usage? Okay. If you ask me to talk about more stuff, you'll probably get less detail, just saying. Yeah.
Okay.
That's what you want. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Question five in the fall 2018 midterm about pthreads.
Okay. Okay. And yeah.
Where the prep thing goes in front of memory and it's just a curve for where it doesn't memory.
Okay. Yeah.
Semaphores.
Semaphores. Can we be more specific? Like
any and everything about
semaphores. So no, okay. I just say if you ask for less specific things or more things, you'll get less detail. So anything else? Yes. So. Okay. So. Just multi. That's what you wanted for the. Okay. 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 Yeah.
Just scheduling and when to use which algorithm in certain situations.
Okay.
Stuff like that.
So we'll do. Any other topics before I start going through things? Yes.
File descriptors.
Okay. File descriptors. Okay. Okay, so I'll start with kernel versus user mode. So there are some operations are dangerous. So we'll say, like, changing the page table base pointer. Why is that dangerous? If you allow anyone to do this, they'll corrupt other programs' memory. So we don't want to allow anyone to do that. Other things are like accessing the hard drive. If we allow anyone to do this, they'll corrupt other users' files or read files they aren't supposed to. You know, so there's a bunch of things like this. Another example was changing the exception table pointer. If you allow anyone to do this, they might hang the system because they'll prevent exceptions from being handled by the operating system. So, you know, kernel mode is processor support for limiting these dangerous operations. The way it works is dangerous operations in kernel mode work. Dangerous operations in not kernel mode, which is mode, which equals user mode, cause an exception. And entering kernel mode, exception handlers run in kernel mode, returning from an exception handler restores prior user mode. If we got an exception from kernel, from user mode. So this ensures that things happen. So some subtleties are like, when do we actually switch to kernel mode? So the important thing to remember is that this is the only reason we switch to kernel mode. So is from exception. So your question should be not just like, do we need to do this in kernel mode? Is there a reason to have an exception here? So for example, you might say, well, decorating the stack pointer allocates memory, and I can't change page tables except in kernel mode, but we know decorating the stack pointer doesn't trigger an exception, because you're just doing an add instruction. That can't do an exception. So does something happen in kernel mode? So the first question is there a reason, for an exception to happen? E.g., is something going to make a system call? A system call, is something going to access invalid memory, etc. So often you'll think there's a reason for a system call. So like malloc, you might say, well, that might, to allocate memory, that can make a system call because it's written to know about how to ask for memory. But something like decrementing the stack pointer. So example, decrementing the stack pointer. Stack pointer, no reason for exception. If the OS allocates stack memory on demand happens when program tries to use that memory, which we discussed last time. And that's the exception that enters kernel mode. You know, example, malloc needs to change the page table sometimes, and that will make a system call. System call enters kernel mode. And generally, you should think about, is the thing I'm trying to do, does it involve one of these sorts of these kinds of dangerous operations that we shouldn't allow programs to do directly for determining whether some function needs to make a system call to implement that? Yes.
How does that pertain to the user data, like versus kernel data? Like, is the mode checked when trying to access?
Yeah. So another dangerous operation is accessing pages marked as kernel mode only in the page table. So if you're trying to do something which accesses accesses the kernel's data structures, that's going to need kernel mode unless the kernel was kind enough to did not set the kernel mode only bit in the page table for you. And you can think of this, so for another example is write to a pipe, need to access kernel's data structures about what's in the pipe, probably. Could imagine doing that with shared memory, but it sounds like the way we've discussed it being implemented, that's a kernel data structure, which is the kernel's part of memory only. You're not going to be able to access that without going into kernel mode. Okay, other questions? Okay, so one question, drop frame rotation. So when an exception happens, XP6 saves the drop frame on the kernel stack. That's where it is. So it's the kernel stack because the kernel is doing the saving, and XP6 has this rule that, you know, XP6 kernel never, you know, puts things on the user stack, you know, exception is like if user passes stack pointer to read, etc. In that case, obviously it will, but otherwise, it doesn't do it unsolicited. It uses the kernel stack, it doesn't interfere with the user stack. And it saves the trap frame as part of handling an exception. So context switches. So in XP6, the context switch always happens. So always happens after saving state for an exception. So we already are in an exception handler. So we've already saved the user data into the stack. So user data stored in a trap frame on the kernel stack. And in XP6, context switches always switch to something, to a program, to kernel mode, to another thing running in kernel mode. Kernel mode, meaning that we're not going to directly restore the user state. So if switching to another process, its registers were saved by a prior exception on its kernel stack. So they'll always be there, you know, in the same place as where they are when we're switching from it, but on the other kernel stack. And we have a general rule that it's on the kernel stack of the process that was running, right? We don't ever choose a random kernel stack. It's always the one that's currently active. Yes?
Wait, where did, so when you run this, when you call the system call, where do you store the arguments for it?
Question is, where are the arguments for a system call? Which we don't have that here. So the arguments for a system call arguments are on the, so I guess we'll just add a thing for that. System call arguments. They are on the user stack. And this is because of the 32-bit x86 calling convention. Like, this is a calling convention thing. This is not like you have to put the arguments on the user stack because that's how OSs work. This is just XP6 made a calling convention choice. And the system calls read by looking up the user stack pointer. Yes?
Can we later go over then, like, 2019's midterm, spring semester midterm question two, then in that case later?
We'll have a second round for that. Yes?
On the trap frame location, so it makes sense with one core, but then I remember you had a diagram of like multiple processes, multiple threads, and like how does all of that?
Yes. So the question is, how does this work with multiple cores? Or we'll start with multiple threads. So with multiple threads, I really should not a written process, but say thread that is running. And each thread will have its own kernel stack. With multiple cores, like, you know, it's just that each thread has its own kernel stack, so we'll have separate kernel stacks for every core, because we won't run the same thread on two cores at the same time, because that would be very confusing. Yeah?
For the system call arguments, is the system call number also stored in the same
area? The question is, where is the system call arguments? The system call number is in user EAX lookup from TrapFrame. This is, again, this is just a calling a convention choice. Like, XV6 had to make a choice about where to put it. They just arbitrarily chose this. Okay. So then we have what system calls context switch. So I guess there's two categories. The main category is when the current program can't keep running. Example, waiting for a key press. If you're waiting for a key press, you're not going to just have an infinite loop where you check for a key press over and over again. If you're implementing that system call, you're going to switch to another program rather than just waste time. The other case when a system call would context switch is if a system call explicitly requests one. So XV6, our version of XV6 has a yield system call which does this. Like the purpose of the system call is switch to another program now. Otherwise, system calls generally don't context switch. You might say, what about if we run out of our time slice? Typically, you'll get a timer interrupt instead. And the timer interrupt handler will context switch, not the system call. Yes?
Will it wait for the system call to finish, or can it?
The question is, will it wait for the system call to finish on XV6? No. Whether or not this happens isn't a design decision where OSs differ. So then we have kernel buffering. So the kernel has its own buffer. So the kernel, you know, typically calling read or write doesn't fetch data directly from the hard drive process at the other end of the pipe network. Instead, it fetches data from a buffer that the kernel maintains. And the reason for this, some reasons are that data for read could come in before you call read, and then we need a place to put it. Like if it comes in from the network, you should put it there. Another reason is that what other process or hard drive or etc. Send the OS is not the same amount that you read. E.g., hard drive gives you, 1,024 bytes, but you read 700. The OS needs to handle that inconsistency and wants to keep around those 1,024 bytes. So when you read the next 300 bytes, you read 700, but you read 700. OS should keep 1024, so when you call read again, it can use the remainder. So if you read 700, then read 300 or 500, you want to get you know, use that remainder of that 1024 bytes, not ask for it again each time you read a little piece of it. And if we're like reading from another program, the program writes a lot into the pipe and you read a little bits, we don't want to like make the program like only copy a little bits, we want to copy a bunch of it and give you what we have. Yes?
So in the buffer that you mentioned before, what happens if too much data enters that buffer? Like, you haven't like called the write, and then there's a lot of stuff has been
rejected. Okay. So I guess I'll get to that in, okay. Well, I need to talk about write. So data for write can't make it to the destination right away. It's another reason to buffer. Okay. And the usual, so you're asking, in that case, well, what happens if there's not enough space for the data to buffer? You know, OS will keep some extra, and sometimes, like, some extra, but not too much. Write return will return less than you ask for, if not enough space. So, like, for example, with the network, like, the OS can't just send stuff from the network all the time because the network's only so fast, but it will keep a certain amount of stuff around that you write and send it as the network's ready to receive it. But if you put too much there, it's just going to say, sorry, I can't do that, and returning from write that it couldn't write everything. Okay. Other questions? Yes.
CL print FF like buffers, how does that tie in with the
So standard IO and IO stream buffers are in addition to kernel buffers. So if you see out something, it goes into cout's buffer, which eventually goes into the kernel's buffer, which eventually goes to the actual destination. And cout and the kernel make their own decisions about when they remove stuff from their buffer. So for example, cout does it when you use endl, and when it runs out of space, the kernel will have different policies depending on what device it is. Yes? We'll add that as a later topic. Lock. Right, I guess we have. And. Okay. Other things on buffering? Okay. So, multi-level feedback queues. So the idea here is use priority scheduling to approximate SRTF, that's shortest remaining time first. So idea high priority equals short CPU burst. So we want to put the processes which have short CPU burst at high priority. So we do two things. So first we enforce that high priority processes have short CPU bursts by giving them a small time quantum and moving them to lower priority if they use the whole thing. Saying they should have a short CPU burst, we'll make sure they do by revoking their high priority if they actually don't. And move low priority processes that don't use their whole CPU, don't use their whole time quantum, to higher priority. And I guess we should say lower priorities get larger and larger time quantums, meaning that we can now take advantage of just the signal of, did you use your whole time quantum, as a signal of, are you at the correct priority level? So one intuition is that processes should end up around the priority level with the time quantum that corresponds, that matches their CPU burst length. And they will actually end up alternating because they'll use less than, they'll probably actually end up alternating. It depends on exactly like how long they use, because they'll use less than priority X and more than X plus ones. Yeah.
Two questions. So one is, there's a quiz question that like had process A run for a certain amount and then run again, like waiting immediately, and then B would do the same thing with a certain amount of time.
Yeah.
So does waiting basically count as like a really small running time? Like if it starts and waits immediately?
So what do you mean, it starts and waits immediately? Oh.
Like what's this like total running time in that situation? Because like,
so if it needs to run on the CPU at all, then that's a very small running time. If we just say it's waiting, then that means it's like that it's already been put to sleep, and it's not going to use the CPU at all. So it's not going to matter what priority it's at. The scheduler's not going to consider it. And hopefully we'll be clear about that in a question, about whether we mean that it runs just long enough to go to sleep, or whether it's already asleep. If we aren't, you should like tell us right on the exam, hey, I'm not sure what you mean, and make your best guess as to what we mean. And generally, if we have, we'll take that into account when writing.
And then the second one was, if we see a question about multi-level feedback keys on the exam, do we also assume that it does that thing where if one process has been waiting for a long time, it changes its like wait time for the like.
So the question is, do we assume that if we talk about a multi-level feedback queue that we have some strategy to avoid starvation? We will be explicit about that. If there is one. Yeah. Okay. Other questions about multi-level feedback queues? So then, which scheduler when? So I had this summary slide you can find. I'm finding it, and which told you which has like the summary of this. So the question is, what metric do you care about? So we have, for example, throughput. Yeah. The problem is too many context switches. So, and that's one problem. The other problem that causes bad throughput is complicated scheduling decision. Like if I have to like scan a list and to figure out which lottery ticket I chose, that might be slow. So our go-to scheduler, which doesn't have these problems, is first come, first served. Because the scheduling decision is take the head of a linked list, really simple, and we minimize context switches because we don't context switch in the middle of a program unless the program stops. So then we had sort of turnaround time or wait time. These aren't the same thing, but optimizing the average of turnaround time is the same as optimizing for the average wait time, because they're related And here the problem is, you know, need to prioritize the short CPU bursts. So shortest remaining time first, if we can do preemption. That's what we want. And SJF, if we shortest job, and if we can't, we're going to do a non-preemptive version of that, which is what we call it shortest job first. So let's see. Then we talked about fairness. And fairness, remember, has multiple definitions. So fairness. And one idea of fairness is, you know, equal chance to run when you can run as anyone else. And we could achieve this. And this is what round robin does. Round robin goes through and divides up the time evenly, exactly evenly over time, for all the things that can run. But it doesn't do anything special if, like, you needed to wait to run. So we also had, so equal chance to run over time, and this was a sort of CFS-like virtual time scheme. So equal amount, I guess not chance, but equal amount run. Yeah, equal amount run. Chance to run. Robin, amount running as everyone else. Yes?
What does CFS stand for again?
The Linux is completely fair scheduler. Yes.
How does the wait for the completely fair scheduler change kind of like the order in which things run, or does it not really?
It does. So the question is, how does the wait affect? I guess I have a separate category. But round robin, I guess equal chance to run is lottery with equal ticket weights is another thing which would do that. So then we had weighted fairness, where some people get twice as much time. So, you know, where everyone has weight equal, you know, weight 2 equals you should run twice as much, or something like that. And we can do this with, so for running when you can run, we lottery did that. Twice the ticket count. And for amount of CPU time over time, CFS-like virtual time scaled by, divided by your weight, I should say. Wait, so if we divide your time by 2, that means that you need twice as much time to be equal to someone else. So you get to run twice as much as someone else. Wait, of 1, yes.
How would that go with like real-time schedulers?
So I have some more categories. So then we have some strange categories. So then we have some things are more important, and this is priority scheduling. And then I have deadlines, and this is where we want real-time schedulers like earliest deadline first. Okay, so questions about any of these? So now I need to pull up exam questions. Hopefully, website files. And we want S2019 midterm. Take the key. Okay. And we want question 4. Which was asking about, let's see if pasting works from my PDF. If not, I have a backup plan. Good enough. So question 4 had this code, and the question is, what is the output of this code? So let's through. So we have one part which is going to run in the child. So these parts are going to run in the parent. And these parts are going to run in the child. And I probably should have passed an argument to xset. That was a mistake on the exam. So in the parent, first we're going to, this is make this here, says make standard out file no refer to the read end of the pipe. Now that seems like an error, and it probably is, but fortunately we never use standard out file no after this. So it doesn't matter. And the trick with this question is that it's trying to get you to think that standard out was shared between the parent and the child. But remember, parent and child, remember, parent, the array of file descriptors is separate for each process. So changing what standard out file no does in the parent doesn't change it in the child. Because we did it after fork, it has no effect on what happens in the child. Then we have a wait PID, so we know the parent is going to wait for it to finish, which doesn't actually change the output, because there's nothing after here. So then we write hello to standard out in the child, and this always runs. And we write bye to the pipe. And write bye to the pipe. And this, you know, if no room in pipe, this hangs. This hangs because the parent doesn't read. If room in pipe, doesn't go anywhere. So this write of bye doesn't do anything either way. So either it hangs or it doesn't, but even if it goes into the buffer for the pipe, no one's reading it, no one cares what goes there, doesn't go to our output. So the only thing which affects our output is this write of hello. Yes?
Can that write to standard file out also hang?
Can the write to standard out also hang? So not if we are collecting our output somewhere. So if we're writing this in a place where we could see the output, it won't hang, right? Because something is showing the output. Yes?
What does it mean to connect the read end of the pipe to standard out?
The question is, what does it mean to connect the read end of the pipe to standard out? This means that later on, I could do read FDs of zero, sorry, standard out file no something. And that would work. And read from the pipe. Pipe. Probably not useful. So it's probably not useful, but that's what it means. Like, it's just another version name for the read pipe and file descriptor. If I try to write to that, I'm going to get an error. And write standard out file no is going to be an error that's read-only. That's a read file descriptor.
So how would you manipulate file descriptor such that you have the read end of the pipes go directly to standard out?
So the question is, how could I make the read end of the pipe go directly to standard out? With POSIX, there's not a way to do that. You have to read from it yourself and write to standard out yourself. Yeah?
Not in this case, but if the parent and the child both successfully finished, but the parent finished before the child will be, it'll finish its thing, it'll just be a zombie.
So the question is, if the parent finished first, if we didn't have this wait PID, what would happen to the child? The child would keep running. But a different process would be responsible for waiting for it. Yes. And as long as that different process didn't decide to kill it, there's no problem. I had the wait PID here mainly to prevent questions about, do we wait for the parent to finish and then stop collecting output? Okay. Other questions? So file descriptors generally are, you can think of as array of pointers to file information. And dupe2 copies one, copies pointer from one element to another. Another close nulls an element. And does appropriate garbage collection. And open pipe, etc. Use free array elements, free currently null. And this is, so there, this is per process. So we don't have to worry about, so if you change it in one process, you don't change it in the other. They might point to the same file, open file, but when you change what the array elements are, that's independent for each process. So dupe2 only affects the current process. Close only affects the current process, and so on. Yes?
How are the, like when you run exec and you replace like the process image, how
does it combine? So exec doesn't change the open files as far as we've discussed. If you like read the POSIX documentation, there's some cases we have, there's some things we haven't discussed which do it on exec, but for the most, as far as we've discussed, exec doesn't change the file descriptors. Okay, then we got the fall 2018 midterm. So pthreads question, and let me see if I can. It's number 5. Okay, this code, right. Right, the one where I have a like half page explanation in the key, which might be a hint that people found the question confusing. So it's asking, what are possible outputs for this code? And the question, so possible outputs, assuming no memory, no load store reordering. So remember we talked about load store reordering can like do all sorts of crazy things. This is saying, assuming there's no load store reordering, what are the possible outputs? So basic idea is that x is set to 100 and is shared between the parent and the child. So we can say that when we get that, we're going to start with it being 100, and then the question is, do we run A or B first? And then do we run C or D first? I guess I should actually have, I should mark this as C, and this is D, and this is E. So something we can say is because of this join, we know that E runs after B, C, and D. We know that's true because there's a join, we wait for the thread to finish. Everything else we know, and we know that, I guess I should have this as a separate list. So, and we know that D runs after B and C, and that C runs after B. That's all we know, but we don't know when A runs relative to this. So A could run here, or here, or here, or here. And we just need to consider all those possibilities. Yes? So the question asks, which are possible? So you have to consider all the possibilities. Those are all the places A can run. You have to think about what is the outputs there. And helpfully, like, if it runs, like, it running, so you just need to think about what are all the possibilities there. Now, helpfully, it seems that it running here versus here doesn't actually change anything, or here versus here doesn't change anything.
Why would it run those different places?
Because it's in the main thread and it's in the child thread, so it depends what our scheduler decides to do. So it just depends, when does the scheduler switch between threads, or if they're running on separate cores, when is one core faster or slower? Okay, so that handles the straightforward parse. The thing which really confused people on this question is that this is not, there is a case I'm missing here because of how this works. Can someone tell me what that is? There's a very subtle case which I haven't enumerated, which will happen. Yes?
The write might not immediately follow the
read. Yeah, so we're assuming here that the way this is, that this is atomic, but the question just says loads and stores are atomic. And the way this is implemented turns out to be that we load x, you know, so we have temp gets to load x, then we say temp is temp plus 10, and then we do store temp into x. And the problem is that A can happen at all those places. And the same thing is true for D here. So we need to consider all those results. So there's cases where what's going to happen is we're going to add 10, but it's not going to really, we're going to, that. So the net effect of this is that if A happens here, if here, then x equals x minus 1 is lost. The same is true here. So one possibility is A appears not to happen at all because it gets in the middle of the plus 10 operation. So this yields are, so the possibilities to consider, A happens before B, A happens during B or D, effectively A's result is lost. And then we have A happens after B before C, and after C before D, or after D. We also have a third and really annoying possibility, and that's the problem that A also gets split up like that. So we can have, or A happens overlapping with B, C, D. So example would be A reads before B, but stores after D. So we need to consider those possibilities. Yes?
Was this a mistake when you wrote this in, that like, it was going to be this
complicated? I have made these types of questions not quite so complicated going forward. It was, yeah, for the number of points it shouldn't have been this complicated. Yeah.
You said E runs after B, C, D. Isn't it also A too? Or no?
And yes, and A. E definitely runs after A. Yes. Yeah. The possibilities aren't near as quite as bad as they seem because many of them just produce the same results. But yes, it is a bit. There's a lot of them still. Okay. Other questions about this? Okay, so mutex implementation. So our mutex implementation sketch is that we have a struct containing a spin lock and a list of waiting threads and a status locked or not. And the locked operation, lock mutex operation, is lock spin lock, check status. If status equals locked, add self to waiting threads, release mutex, and go to sleep. And yeah, you know, so this is if status otherwise set status equal locked and unlock, release mutex. And the unlock mutex is lock spin lock status equals not locked, wake up a waiting thread. Or sorry, if there's a waiting thread, if waiting thread, wake up waiting thread, else status equals not locked. So that was our one a possible, you know, mutex implementation. This is one possibility. There's other ways you could implement a mutex, but this is one way of doing it. Yes. Oh, sorry. I mean, I release mutex is a typo. Okay. I meant release spin lock. So the convention here is the spin lock is always locked before reading list of waiting thread, before using list of waiting threads or the status. Release, yes, that should be spin lock as well. Sorry. And this should be spin lock. I probably should be consistent and say lock, unlock, or acquire release. So. Yes. And mutex usage is lock before, you know, choose a mutex that covers each thing you share. Lock before accessing the thing you share. Unlock afterwards. That's the usage. Yes?
If you have a lock and a lock, always unlock them in like opposite order.
So this is on. So. With deadlock, in general, you want to have a consistent order. The opposite order doesn't actually matter. Like, in my code, I always did lock A, lock B, then unlock B, unlock A. But that doesn't matter. You can do it in the other order. Like, it doesn't matter what order you unlock them in. Yes. So, I guess in a monitor, this state is what do is this state includes? Do I need to wait? So that's the important thing. So the idea is you lock the mutex to check if you need to wait and know that that won't change. So purpose of monitor. Locking mutex means that you know it won't. You won't suddenly not need to wait after you decide to wait. So some people, like for the pool assignment, who didn't lock a mutex, like had a bug where they would hang because they would say, "Is there anything waiting on the queue?" "No, there isn't." "Okay, I'll go to sleep." But if the mutex lock didn't prevent that from changing, then they'd check if there's something on the queue. They'd say, no, there isn't. Then a thread would add something to the queue, and then they'd go to sleep because there was no lock to prevent that from happening. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yeah.
Can you explain that from the pool assignment?
more in depth, like as like a consumer therapy? Because that might be my problem.
That's probably another topic I'm not sure I'll get to given I have 20 minutes. We'll see. Okay, so someone asked reader writer lock. So I guess we should, I'll start with usage because it's less obvious what a reader writer lock is. So the idea is mutex can only be held by one thread, but this seems wasteful since multiple threads can read something at the same time. So the purpose of the reader-writer lock is, there's a read lock is lock for reading, and this means multiple threads can do this at once. Because it's safe for multiple threads to read. Write lock is lock for writing, and one thread at a time, don't allow other writers or readers to act at the same time. And we talked about implementing reader-writer locks primarily with monitors, but the basic idea is you track the number of readers or writers, use some sort of simpler lock to protect your tracking of the number of readers or writers. Use that number you're tracking. Use the tracked number to decide when to wait or not. So with pthreadcond wait, or if you were implementing it with semaphores, with semwait. And if you care about whether readers or writers go first, also track the number of waiting readers or writers to decide whether to wait, taking that into account. So if you're tracking the number of waiting, e.g., if writers go first, readers check if there are waiting writers. Question?
Does the pthreads implementation that we use favor readers or writers?
Question, does the pthread RW lock favor readers or writers? This is unspecified. Okay. Other questions? Sorry. Yeah.
Is there a general rule like how you use mutexes when there's shared data?
How you use mutexes when they're shared data, when you use a condition variable?
Like a general rule of when you want to use a condition variable.
Condition variable is when you need to wait for something to happen. Okay. So, you should never think, I want to wait for something to happen, I'm going to check if it's true in a loop without doing something to, like, not use all the CPU time. And conwait is a way of doing that. You can also use semaphores to do that with semwait if you set things up. So going to semaphore. So we talked about, so semaphores have a count, which is, you can think of as something like number of slots available. And there's a operation called down, which is down or wait or a bunch of other things, P, which is reserve a slot, or if one is not available, wait until it is. And we have an operation called up, or wait, or up, or post, or V, which is make a new slot available, which might wake up a thread that previously asked to reserve one. So those are our two operations, and our intuition is what number can we track where I want to wait when the number is zero? Like that's an intuition for how should I set up my semaphores? Think of what can I track that should be zero when I need to wait. So like a number of elements in a buffer that are available to use, that sort of thing. You know, example, number of free spaces in a buffer. Another sort of a common pattern is you can have a, so mutex is semaphore is one when unlocked, zero when locked. Another common pattern is a gate. Semaphore start at zero, call down to wait for another thread to let you go, and another thread calls up. So this is where you, you know, choose how many threads go. So in this pattern, you keep track of how many threads you need to let go, and you call up that number of times. Okay. Questions on semaphores? Okay. So then we have calculating page table addresses. First thing is you want to do is split up the address. So the idea is that we're going to go from we're going to have a virtual address plus a page table base address plus, you know, whatever's in the page tables. So first step is to split the virtual address. So the virtual address is going to be composed of a virtual page number and a page offset. And the virtual page number is going to be divided into parts. In our case, we had two parts, because that's what 32-bit x86 does. Some processors, especially if you have 64-bit virtual addresses, are going to have more parts. And use the first part as an array index into the first level page table. So index 0 of the first level page table is the page table base address, which is usually stored in a register when a process is running. And index 1 of the table, index 1 is the base address plus the size of a page table entry. Index 2 is plus 2 times the size of a page table entry. And index VPN part 1 is the base address plus the size of a page table entry times that first part of the address. And a lot of people forget that you have to take into account how big is the page table entry because it's an array. Usually not an array of bytes because it's hard to store an address in one byte that we would like to use. So the first level page table entry gets you the base address for the second level, but usually as a page number, not a byte address. So if you want to convert from a page number to a byte address, we can know that a physical address is going to be composed of a physical page number. This is what we store in page table entries, and a page offset, which is the same size as in our virtual addresses. And we know that it starts at the beginning of the page, physical page, so the page offset of the base address for the second level is going to have zero in the page offset part. and then follow same math, but with a different base address and the next part of the VPN. And once you get the last level page table entry, take its physical page number and combine it with the original virtual address's page offset. Yes?
For the physical address that you get from the first level, adding an amount of zeros to get the base address, is that based on the VPN?
So the question is, how many zeros do I add? It's based on the page offset, and the page offset is, you know, big enough to identify a byte in a page, or which means it's going to be log base 2 of the page size. And the page size is always the same for both virtual and physical, or else things wouldn't make sense. You'll have to know what the page size is. Yeah.
What do you mean by using it as a page number, not a byte address?
So in the page table entry, they typically only store this part of the physical address. Rather than, so they store a page number, so you can think of it as if we have, you know, if I have an array, like I could tell you element 10 of the array, or I could tell you byte 40 of the array, and they mean the same thing. We store the equivalent of 10 in the page table entries, where our array is array of pages, not like 4-byte values. Does that make sense? And I said usually because, like, there's nothing stopping a processor from deciding we'll store a byte address there, but typically they don't, just to save space.
So that physical page number from the first one points to the base of the second one, right?
Yes. So the physical page number in the first one points to the base of the second one. If you had more levels, you'd keep doing that until you get to the last one. Yes.
In the last lecture, you did, like, that one example where you had, like, two of the entries and then, know how many entries you would have total in the first and the second, and then all of the entries. Can you explain that? Is it like each entry has a pointer to it, and it's an own entire?
So if we have a process's page table, so the question is, like, how do we figure out how much space I need for page tables? So first of all, you need to figure out how big is each page table. Usually it's a page, but some processors this doesn't work out. On 32x86, it happens to work out nicely. That it's a page, exactly. And then the question is, well, how many page tables at each level do we need? We always need one at the first level, or else no memory can be valid. And any memory that's valid needs to have a second level table to point to it. And we can't, like, only store part of a second level table. We need to store whole second level tables. So we need to, you know, fill in an entry in the first level table. So when we had the example of one valid page, we needed a first level page table to look up. And then when we got to the second level, we needed to get a real base address that pointed to something else. So you needed a second level table for it to find. When everything is valid, every single address needs a real base address, which means we're going to check every single entry of the first level table. And we need a second level table for each one, assuming all the addresses are distinct. And if we had less of that, you just need to consider, well, how many second-level tables do these cover? Like, are they all in the same second-level? Do they all use the same second-level table when we do this, or not? And that depends on, well, like, one way of thinking about it is we need a second-level table for every distinct virtual page number part one we have that we want to be valid. Is that?
Yeah, so if you have, like, two entries, three entries, you would have, like, three separate one for each one of those entries.
So in the first level table, if we have three valid pages, if they all have the same virtual page number part one, we only need one entry in the first level table and one second level page table for them. If they all have different values for that virtual page number part one, they each need their own second level table.
And that first page table is like a range?
Yeah, so each entry, the question is the first table here looks like range, so each entry in the first level table used for range of virtual page numbers corresponding, which have the same VPN part one. Like this way of thinking about this. So, and each second level table is shared by virtual page numbers that have the same VPN part one. Okay, so I think I'm gonna run out of time. So then we had a question, deadlock hanging with read and write. So the question here is, if we write and no one is reading, then that write can run out of space, and with pipes, it will wait for space. Typically. With default settings, you can disable that and have it return an error instead, but you have to do something special. So when analyzing that situation, you should say, when we're doing this write, do we know that someone's reading? And if you can't show that someone's reading, then we might have a problem. So if you can't show someone's reading, have a problem. If you can show that someone definitely, that show that it's definitely the case that no one is reading, then you definitely have a problem. And you, I guess, almost certainly have a problem. Like, maybe there's enough space in the buffer, but. How this works will depend on your situation. So in some of the situations we had, like, two people try to write to a pipe and then read from the opposite pipe. Well, in that case, we had this issue that we can't show someone was ever reading the pipe. And that's why we could have hanging. Questions on this? Okay, and I guess I had vague ideas, so I'll take my 2-minute lightning round questions. Yeah. So implement is wait for keyboard input implemented with a CV in the kernel, and the answer is sometimes, or sometimes a semaphore. I think it's a semaphore in XV6. Not sure. It's something else in XV6. Sometimes, but means the kernel needs its own CV implementation. And sometimes there's one of those, sometimes there's something else, but yeah, it could be. Yeah?
How in-depth would we go into like event-based programming and messaging?
Question, how in-depth?
I guess I didn't give
any real code, but I expect you to know at a high level like why they're useful. And
in one of the tests or the quizzes, you had fflush. Can you explain what that does again, real quick?
Fflush is empty the cout or the printf buffer.
So it'll go to the screen.
So it will go to the kernel, and if your kernel wants to send it through the screen, which it does for like your console, it will. If it's like a pipe, something else might happen. Yes. Yeah.
Can you briefly re-explain event-based coding?
So. I think this is going to be the last question given time. So event-based programming, rather than having thread A read from X and thread B read from Y, I guess read-write, have one thread which ask for what's the next thing I can do with X and Y in a loop. that's the idea of event-based programming, is that rather than having separate threads for each thing, like each web browser we're talking to, we have one thread and we have a loop where we say, what's the next read or write I can do? Okay, and I think I'm out of time, so I'll see you next Tuesday. I have office hours as usual if you want to take advantage of that.
Quick question.